From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana.
Will this institution survive the stench that this creates in the public perception that the Constitution and its reading are just political acts?
Elections have consequences. How often have we heard that? And those consequences come in many forms, one of the most lasting being the Constitution of the Supreme Court. With the most conservative lineup in a lifetime, the justices are pondering to foundational religious freedom cases as we speak. And attorney J. Michelson will be back with us to examine the implications.
And I am tired of communities of faith being weaponized and being mischaracterized because the only time religious freedom is invoked is in the name of bigotry and discrimination.
On December 14th, Interfaith Alliance is presenting an online webinar on a critically important topic, the cornerstone principle of religious freedom as it was envisioned by our founders. We'll get a briefing from Alliance Director of Field and Organizing, Maureen O'Leary.
Members of this third sex, including homosexual people, are not ostracized from the religion. In fact, they are sometimes even considered to have divine powers or insights. So that's pretty cool.
A couple of months ago, a disturbing story made the rounds in equality advocacy circles regarding the backlash to a Hindu priest in Toronto, Canada, who had performed a same-sex marriage. A number of groups have stepped up in defense, including the Coalition of Progressive Hindus. We'll get an update from Coalition Board Member Nikhil Mandala Partha.
I'm Ray Kirstein at the intersection of religion, politics, and the speck in my neighbor's eye. Public Religion Research Institute released some eye-opening findings this week. In a broad survey of Americans, only 1 in 10 says their religion prohibits COVID-19 vaccination. Among the unvaccinated, however, one-third have or plan to demand religious exemptions for their God-given right to spread the deadly pandemic further. At the same time, some 66% of respondents say too many people are using religious exemptions to avoid civic responsibility for fighting the pandemic together. A Methodist pastor in Evansville, Indiana, agreed to take to his pulpit dressed in drag in an attempt to embody his lifelong message that, quote, God loves you, period, as you are, where you are. He even did it on TV for the HBO program We're Here, a show that visits small towns across the nation to raise up and validate queer lives and identities where they are often the least visible and most vulnerable, and doing so by engaging usually heterosexual locals in the art form of drag. And for that, Pastor Craig Duke lost his job. Empathy and common ground are usually discovered in the episodes of the show, as well as in the teachings of Christianity. Unless, of course, your church punishes you, your wife, and daughter for trying to live out those values. And as if SCOTUS doesn't have enough to keep its majoritarian little hands busy, a rabidly anti-gay religious organization is asking the Supremes to take its case, already lost in many a lower court, to punish the Southern Poverty Law Center for calling its hate-mongering hate. For good measure, Robert Kennedy Ministries goes on to name-call SPLC, quote, reputational terrorists, end quote. The self-proclaimed ministry has for decades promoted hateful slurs like gays want sex with children and gays want to be able to marry a Volkswagen. Nope, no hate here.
Our program airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. State of Belief Radio is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, please let me say a very sincere thank you. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. And now to our first guest. Dr. Jay Michelson is an author, an activist, and a prolific commentator on goings-on at the highest court in the land, where this month cases were heard that may well give one strain of Christianity dominance over all Americans like we haven't seen in over a century. We've seen nothing less than a direct challenge to Roe v. Wade, as well as to the separation of public funding and religious education in the past 2 weeks. And I'm grateful, very grateful, to have Jay with us again to address the ramifications. I always learn from him. We always learn from him. Jay, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Wilton. It's always good to be here.
You were with us not long ago to foreshadow how this conservative high court would likely handle the Dobbs v. Jackson case. What caught your attention about the arguments that we heard December 1st?
Well, right. This is our I Told You So episode, when the Texas restrictions on abortion came up, and we were, you know, justifiably concerned about that. I said, you know, never mind Texas. The real thing is Mississippi. And this is a frontal challenge to Roe versus Wade that I think the court will take. I told you so, unfortunately. We told your listeners.
Yes.
So I think a lot of folks were surprised by how direct the openness was in the oral argument toward overturning Roe versus Wade. Some of the language coming from Justice Barrett was a little surprising, that, you know, we tolerate incursions on bodily autonomy all the time, as if a vaccine mandate to save life, you know, was the same as forced pregnancy and forcing women to give birth. That was pretty shocking and kind of went unchallenged. You know, it's not really the place of Supreme Court advocates to challenge a justice on some statement like that, but it was certainly a shocking statement. So I think the overtness that the court seemed, or the court's conservatives seemed to display, to go for broke, you know, not do a sort of Justice Roberts compromise where maybe 15 weeks is okay, but to have an abortion ban, but not, you know, totally overturn Roe v. Wade. That did not seem like a popular position. And it seems almost certain that the core of Roe will be overturned in the springtime.
A new poll shows 40% of respondents now believe this case will lead to the reversal of Roe v. Wade. At the same time, we know a large majority of Americans support some degree of reproductive freedom. So how can we reconcile that? Shouldn't we be seeing more public concern and protest, even if it's mostly symbolic?
Well, it is, though, mostly symbolic. The ship has sailed, right? I mean, the three Trump appointees to the Supreme Court, all handpicked by the Federalist Society and with a very, not just a religious bias, but a very arch conservative religious fundamentalist bias, judging, you know, guiding those three picks. That's totally transformed the court. That's done. So I'm not sure that, you know, hitting the streets now is necessarily going to do anything. I do think, you know, if you look in terms of politics, there's a silver lining. I don't want to say that there's a silver lining to stripping, you know, all women in America of rights to their own bodily autonomy. But in terms of politics, this could help the Democrats if this happens, as expected, in May or June. You know, that's going to be just in time for the 2022 elections. Justice Breyer may or may not retire around that time. So the court will be front and center. And as you noted, public opinion is very different from where the Supreme Court is on this. Mm-hmm. You should definitely expect that dark red states will immediately ban all abortion, certainly Texas and Mississippi, Alabama, and probably several others. So it'll be a very live, real issue. It won't be something hypothetical or some threat in the future. The landscape will change probably as soon as May or June.
26 states are poised to ban abortion if Roe is struck down. California has signaled a willingness to become an abortion refuge state. How on earth did we get here?
we got here through a lot of complacency on the left, honestly, about some of these judicial picks. You know, you and I have been talking about this for a decade now, and sometimes it's whistling in the wind. Obviously, there's a lot of other issues to be concerned about, even before the pandemic, even before Trump, there, you know, even before climate change became as real as it is in our daily lives. There are a lot of things to be concerned about. But there is a sense that the right took the judiciary much more seriously than the left. They had a concerted effort. There's no left-wing equivalent of the Federalist Society and the Judicial Crisis Network. There are good organizations doing really good work, obviously. But in terms of the sort of master plan, in terms of the amount of money and amount of resources, the left was just outgunned on this. And we got to this place because, you know, we've tolerated this to happen. We tolerated, the left sort of went along with Justice Gorsuch's nomination, which was illegitimate. The left, or at least the center, Susan Collins, swore to us that Brett Kavanaugh would not vote to overturn Roe versus Wade, which obviously he is soon to do. Well, I shouldn't say obviously, but likely he's soon to do. And, you know, we've even gone sort of along with the legitimacy of Justice Barrett. And the worst of it, in my opinion, is that this complacency is continuing even now. So there is a commission under President Biden to look at reform of the Supreme Court, and they've released the final draft of that report, and it's toothless. It says nothing. It's like, well, there are a lot of views people feel strongly about the Supreme Court. That is absolutely unacceptable from my perspective. Whether it's adding justices to the court to compensate for the abuses of the previous 4 years, or whether it's adding term limits, which is something that I've gone on record as supporting, that would be effective immediately for Supreme Court justices, something has to be done, not issuing some report that, you know, says that there are a lot of options on the table. Again, maybe there's a silver lining that when this is real in May or June, maybe there will be enough pressure and enough momentum to make some real changes to restore the legitimacy of the court, because everybody knows that the jig is up, that this is just a political arm of the Republican Party at this point. And it pains me to say that. You know, I've been a lawyer for 25 years, and this is not the Supreme Court that I grew up with.
Yeah. In a poignantly personal Huffington Post op-ed, Interfaith Alliance Policy Director Katie Joseph emphasized that Jewish teachings, to take just one example, say life starts at birth, and therefore protecting the life of an expectant mother is paramount throughout the 9 months of pregnancy. So the language being used to assault Roe is not just anti-science, but explicitly violates the deeply held religious beliefs of many Americans. As a rabbi, can you speak to this unconstitutional dead end we find ourselves in?
Well, it'll be interesting to see if what's good for the goose is good for the gander. Maybe the right will support religious exemptions to these abortion bans, right? So there are a lot of religious exemptions for religious conservatives, for folks who have a religious objection to a law. So whether that might be about women or LGBTs or any other issue. So there should be an exemption to every abortion ban, saying that if you have a religious teaching that says that it's required to save the life of a mother, then of course you should have a religious exemption to that abortion ban. Something inside tells me that's not going to happen, but that would be at the very least fair to have an equal religious exemption when a law punishes those who have a different religious belief than the majority.
We have an entire separate crisis in the making with a case the Supremes heard this past Wednesday. What do we need to know about that?
This was another case about public funding of religious schools. Maine has a very unusual program. It's not a school voucher program, but it's a program for people in rural areas to access education where there are no public schools. And that's only Maine and Vermont have that kind of a program. They pay for any private school education, but not religious school. And based on the oral arguments, which I listened to yesterday, it seems certain the court is going to strike that down as unconstitutional because it discriminates against religious parents and religious schools. The issue, though, is that if Maine were to fund religion, will, which will have to, if Maine will fund religious schools, these aren't just schools which happen to be affiliated with a religious order. These are schools which have a religious mission, as well they should. Religious schools are great. There's nothing wrong with religious schools. There's only something wrong with public funding of religious schools. And these schools aren't trying to sneak around or to conform with the law and say we're secular, really. They're proudly religious institutions. They don't just have mandatory chapel service. They don't just have Bible classes. They also, you know, all of the subjects that they teach are from a religious point of view. So whether that's evolution or any other subject, which might, there might be some religious conservative teaching about it, that's how they present it. And that's going to be required to be publicly funded. You know, to me, and this is kind of a long answer, but I think the bigger question that these cases bring up is this word discrimination. So in New York Magazine yesterday, I wrote, wrote out an article about that, that the claim that not getting some sort of benefit and extending a benefit, right? Maine's benefit is secular education for all. But to say, no, actually, I'm also entitled to this other thing, to say not getting that is discrimination, that's not what we usually mean by discrimination. Mm-hmm. And we're going to see that same argument come up in a number of COVID cases, vaccine mandate cases that are coming through. So where I live in New York, there's now a vaccine mandate for religious school teachers as well as for public school teachers. That's certain to be challenged. And, you know, if you think about it, what's being argued or asked for by the religious right is the right to kill other people, right? Mm-hmm. I have a religious belief that suppose I have some religious belief that, you know, makes vaccines not okay. Interestingly, by the way, a poll was released today by PRRI that it's about 10% of Americans. So it's not all evangelicals. It's not all religious conservatives. It's about 1/10 of Americans believe that getting a vaccine would violate their religious tenets. So 1 in 10. Anyway, so if I'm in that 1 in 10, I should be able to go into a crowded restaurant or a crowded theater, even if there's a vaccine mandate, and expose other people to this virus because I have a religious belief. And this, now it starts to look a lot like this inversion of religious freedom that you and I've talked about again for 10 years.
Yeah.
That because I have a religious belief or faith or practice, that I can take away someone else's right to, whether it's to equality or to access healthcare or now even to live. That no state can stop me from, you know, from breaking a public health law. That is what's coming up. And so this is not just something, this case in Maine isn't something that just affects these kids in rural Maine. The principle that this is discrimination affects all of us.
Did you know this was coming on top of where we already were in such turmoil? How did this one get to the SCOTUS level?
Well, it's, you know, there was a case last year about school voucher programs, and that was arguably kind of a bigger case because there are a number of states with school voucher programs. They're much larger than this kind of idiosyncratic Maine program. But this is different in key respects. And so this is expanding that previous case. But, you know, all eyes for the court are focused on abortion and some also on the gun case, which is also a major constitutional case this term. And, this one, it was picked up by good folks, you know, Americans United for Separation of Church and State. There were other organizations who were paying attention to this and a couple of op-eds. And I think the ACLU was paying attention. But, you know, the abortion cases may be different from most of these cases because it's so high profile. A lot of what's happened in the court on religion has been little bit by bit, chipping it away, a lot of it on what's called the shadow docket. So all of those COVID pandemic cases were in what's called the shadow docket because they're not officially on the docket. They're cases that the court takes on a sort of emergency basis. There's a lot less transparency, a lot less accountability. And we saw a huge shift from when Justice Ginsburg was on the court to when Justice Barrett replaced her. You know, 180 degree inversion to now basically exempt churches and religious organizations from any public health law, which to my mind is crazy. I don't think it's discrimination to hold churches to appropriate public health standards. I think that's a standard equal treatment. So we're moving to a place now where what sort of legal scholars call most favored nation for religious claims, where those claims trump any other claim that anyone else might make. And it will be interesting in the abortion case to see if that is also true when it's a progressive or religious progressive making that case, right? Mm-hmm. Religious progressives are religious too. We're not fake. We're real. And now that there are laws that contradict my religious views, I should be able to get the same exemptions that religious conservatives or self-styled religious conservatives get. Again, I'm not sure that's going to happen.
You wrote about the Carson case in New York Magazine, and the headline pulls no punches. The Supreme Court is ready to make taxpayers fund religious schools. Do most people in the United States understand how important this is and what a change it's going to bring about?
No, not at all. Yeah. This is not, you know, this is sort of, you know, there are a lot of school and religion cases, and I'm sure that, you know, the public understanding of this is in the single digits at most. Yeah. But again, that you see a difference between left and right. On the right, these issues are taken very seriously. Right. And I would suspect among, again, the sort of, you know, self-styled religious conservatives, you know, probably a large percentage were following this case, are aware of it. They probably received a lot of fundraising email about it, and they've put it as a priority because they understand that, you know, that this is how this kind of culture war can be fought and won. And just if you reflect on the sort of anti-democratic nature of this, this isn't all religious people who want taxpayer funding of religious schools. This is a small segment of religious people. What, you know, we're thinking maybe 20, 25% of the population at most. And yet, because of the capture of the Supreme Court, that's the law of the land. And this is going to affect much more than just Maine's little program, mm-hmm. right? This will affect any kind of taxpayer, any kind of school choice program, any kind of subsidy program. And to say that you have to fund a religious activity, and not just, again, like, you know, there's another case a few years ago about does a program have to be available to fund the sort of athletic facilities of a religious school, and the court said yes, because this is just a, you know, this is not a religious activity that's being funded, and they should be treated on the same equal footing. But this is totally different. This is, must taxpayer funding be used to fund, you know, mandatory chapel and mandatory Bible instruction, yeah. and all of the things which religious schools do and do very well. And so that, but no, I would say certainly on the leftmost 75% of the country, no one is paying attention to that.
You know, we're facing a situation here where some taxpayers would be forced to fund education, just as we've talked about, that actively condemns and marginalizes them. Take LGBTQI+ taxpayers as an example. How does that play out?
Two of the schools at issue in the main case don't take LGBTQ students and won't employ LGBTQ people as teachers. Again, from a private school perspective, that may be appropriate, certainly on the teacher side, if, you know, they have a particular reading of scripture, and this is, you know, and then people can make the choice whether or not they want to support that. But I don't have, if I'm a Maine taxpayer, I don't have a choice. My taxpayer money is supporting that school, and is not only supporting that school, but is paying for students to go and learn in that environment that's marginalizing me. So, you know, certainly from a taxpayer point of view, that's really troubling. But one of the schools actually has in their curriculum that part of the purpose of their Bible of their, it was in a social studies class, actually, the purpose of the social studies class was to help Christian students fight Islam and defeat the false teachings of the Islamic faith. I think I've got that wording right. Now imagine you're a Muslim taxpayer in Maine and your taxpayer money is going to fight Islam. I mean, that, first of all, you know, that's a pretty offensive thing, even if it's just a private school. But the idea that it's required by the Constitution for taxpayers to fund a school that says we're equipping students to fight the false teachings of the Islamic religion, you know, that is a brave new world that we're living in.
Let me just quickly ask you, the Biden Supreme Court Commission just released its report. Did you see that as good or bad? And do you expect anything come from that?
I am pretty outraged by the mealy-mouthed nature of that report. I suppose on the upside, it kind of lets the president and the Democrats kind of do whatever they want. You know, unfortunately, yet again, this is going to come down to the handful of moderates in the Senate as to whether they want to actually do anything. And it's hard for me to imagine those moderate Democrats going along with a serious plan to reform the Supreme Court. They may even need to suspend the filibuster in order to do it, which makes it doubly unlikely. But I think this commission has wasted a great opportunity, which was to come out behind a particular proposal that remedied in a direct way both the immediate problems of the last few years under Trump, but also of the system itself, right? So life tenure for judges, justices was announced when life expectancy was a lot less than it was now. No one expected people to, you know, there were a couple of exceptions actually on the early Supreme Court, but in the main, there wasn't an expectation that every justice was going to serve on this court for 40 years. So the stakes are just much too high. Right. And it's effectively random when it happens. Right. So because the late Justice Ginsburg died when she did and not 3 months later, you know, now there's no abortion in America. You know, the stakes are much too high for this kind of this process. If we had term limits, if we had sort of a simple way, each justice, and then those were regularized. So it wouldn't even have to be the same number of years, but you knew when the next confirmation battle was going to come. So you couldn't play around with it and play the games that Republicans played in the last few years. You know, this commission was a broad commission of a lot of experts, and I understand it's hard to get agreement, but the reality is they're coming out with nothing. And so that does not strengthen the hand of anyone trying to say, let's go forward, because they can't say we're going to implement what this smart commission said. You know, that's one of the reasons you have smart commissions. So to say it's disappointing is an understatement.
Jay, I very seldom ever do this. Or I don't know whether I have ever done it, but I'm going to today. You've mentioned several times that we've been talking about this stuff for 10 years at least. Now we're looking at a huge – you're kind of a pastor to me. I've read you. I've listened to you. I've watched what you do other places. What should we be feeling? How do we deal with this?
No, I appreciate that, and I appreciate those words. I think you know, for me as a man, I think a lot of the work is on really inhabiting what it would feel like to live in a country that doesn't respect my own humanity and agency. I think, you know, we're two men having this conversation. So I think it's me listening to the voices of women. I think we'll hear a lot more of those voices when this ruling actually comes out. I think now, in a certain way, we're in a kind of waiting period now. You know, we don't know for certain what's going to happen from the Supreme Court. You know, when we do, when that's happened, and when some of those 26 states pass their laws, I think there'll be a great outcry. And hope, you know, again, as a man, I hope I can lend my voice to that and support the voices of women who hopefully will be leading it. And I do think, again, I don't want to really use the language silver lining, because these are people's lives that are at stake. And even if it's, you know, temporary, or it's only in some states or whatever, that, you know, this kind of moral outrage is real. I do think that there's an opportunity for some kind of redemption. You know, we just mentioned that this has been kind of a stealth attack for a long time. It won't be that when this case comes out. It will be, you know, not just headline news, but front and center for folks. I think there'll be, for people who aren't as engaged as you or I, there'll be more of an understanding that this is real. And, you know, we'll hear more stories of women in yeah. you know, tragic situations who were being manipulated by a system that doesn't take their rights into adequate account. So I think there is, I think for me, on a sort of more pastoral, spiritual level, it's preparing for that and preparing to be supportive and understanding that there is redemption here, that I think that the court is so out of step, as you've mentioned, with the large majority of Americans, including people who are personally anti-abortion, but who are, you know, pro-choice because mm-hmm. they don't think that their beliefs should dictate the actions of others. Yeah. And that's a lot of people in the population. So the court is so out of step with that, and these legislators are so out of step with it, we might get actually a real questioning of why are these legislatures so out of step? Well, mm-hmm. because of gerrymandering, because the system is rigged, because of the destruction of the Voting Rights Act, because of systematic disenfranchisement of voters of color. Mm-hmm. So those are all things which we can fight. And which there are great organizations on the ground doing. You know, let's re-register all of those people who were pulled out of the polls. There's a great organization called Students for Justice, which is paying students to do this. individually. You know, they can purge 10,000 voters at a time. We have to go back and reach each one of them individually and get them back on the polls and tell them what's happened to them and tell them that there are people taking away their rights to vote. Because if everybody voted representative of America, the legislatures wouldn't look like they do. Mm-hmm. They would actually look representative. Yeah. And then we could have non-gerrymandered districts. And then we could have something that looks a little more like democracy. So I think it's focusing on those opportunities for redemption. It's good to look backward, as we've done, and see how did we get here. And also, accommodating to this new reality, it's thinking about what we can do to fix it.
Thank you. Rabbi Dr. Jay Michelson is a columnist for New York Magazine and a meditation teacher and podcast host at 10% Happier. He has written about the Supreme Court for the last 8 years, first for the Daily Beast and now for New York, and before that worked as a religious LGBTQ activist for 10 years. Jay is the author of numerous books, most recently Enlightenment by Trial and Error. Jay, as always, thank you for sharing your insights with us on State of Belief Radio.
My pleasure. Keep up the good work.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. Up next, an important founding religious freedom webinar. And later, the Coalition of Progressive Hindus stands with an LGBT-affirming Hindu priest in Toronto. Now, if you miss any part of today's program, you can hear full episodes of State of Belief anytime on our website. You'll also find links to the topics we discussed this week, extended interviews and transcripts, and an archive of past shows, all of that at stateofbelief.com. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, religion and radio done differently. It has long been one of the best things about our nation, the unconditional dedication to religious freedom for all. The hijacking of this precious value by an agenda-driven political religious right has been painful to watch and immeasurably destructive to our democracy itself. Key to standing up for what the founders intended is actually understanding it and why they enshrined it as the first freedom. Interfaith Alliance is presenting an important webinar on the topic this coming Tuesday, and I am happy to welcome Maureen O'Leary back to State of Belief Radio with the details. Maureen, glad to have you back with us.
Good to be here.
So please describe the Tuesday event and who the intended audience is.
Yeah, so the title of the webinar is Founding Religious Freedom. And it's really a webinar for everyone. Recently, we've been having really excellent conversations just in the public space about reaching for a more nuanced understanding of our history and what our American story is. Religious freedom is a key component of that. If we're looking towards what an inclusive vision of religious freedom looks like for the future, we also have to look to our past and the ways that we have fallen short of extending that constitutional right to everybody. And key in that is reaching for a accurate and nuanced understanding of the history of religious freedom. History is often made political, and people use narratives that suit their modern day political agendas. If we want to do better, if we want to correct the wrongs of our history, the people that have, in the case of religious freedom, been subject to religious coercion, that have been unequally protected under the law, we have to acknowledge where that sits in the history of our American narrative. Mm-hmm. So that's what we're hoping to do with this webinar, is dismantle kind of the politicized narrative and get to what a true version of our history is and what that looks like for the future.
Maureen, who will be on the panel?
So first, we're going to have Steve Waldman. He is the president and co-founder of Report for America, and he is the author of this really incredible book. It's a New York Times bestseller called Founding Faith, How Our Founding Fathers Forged a Radical New Approach to Religious Liberty. And it really gets at the question of where is the middle ground between these two politicized narratives of what religious freedom is and what it means. Second, we're going to have Dr. Corey Walker. He's an amazing scholar of African-American social, political, and religious thought and history with an emphasis on religious freedom. So he's going to be providing one of the perspectives of a group that has been not equally protected under the Constitution as it was written at the time. And then our third panelist is Dr. Kristen Carpenter, and she is a professor at the University of Colorado in the University of Colorado Law School. She is a professor of law and director of the American Indian Law Program. So her focus is on how Native peoples and Indigenous peoples have not been protected under the First Amendment and not been afforded the right of religious freedom, even up to modern day. So we're hoping to really get a broad range of perspectives to, you know, really unpack what religious freedom means to protect everyone.
I would like for you to talk about why this is particularly a good moment for the Interfaith Alliance to do this.
We have seen, especially over this past year, a rise in Christian nationalism, both on the state and national level, coming into the legislatures, laws that, you know, really have no constitutional foundation, but are being justified by this false narrative of what it means, what religious freedom means, mm-hmm. In the constitutional sense. Mm-hmm. So Interfaith Alliance, we're looking towards what a more inclusive vision of religious freedom looks like. So pushing back on Christian nationalist narratives with a true and inclusive understanding of what religious freedom and constitutional religious freedom is central to building that future, which is something that we do in our policy work and our field work every single day.
Maureen, would you talk about the toll misinformation about this cornerstone founding value has taken on American democracy and the lives of so many of us?
So there's this idea, and I think, you know, at the time when our nation was, you know, in the beginning stages of figuring out what our story was going to be, what our constitutional values were going to be, it was the majority of the people in the room, the overwhelming majority, were Christian. So that simple fact has been carried into the modern context of the foundational documents are meant to reflect so-called Christian values, and that privileging the beliefs of a few is what our founders intended, which couldn't be further from the truth.
Mm-hmm. What do you hope will come from this webinar? What's the conversation Interfaith Alliance really wants to start and then amplify?
I want people to question their assumptions. I hope that this webinar won't be the end of people thinking about this and self-educating on this issue, but something to inspire and incentivize people to learn more. You know, our religious freedom, you know, it is one of our constitutional rights, but it is a promise that remains unfinished in so many ways. There are so many people that still do not enjoy the same rights to religious freedom as other groups. So getting people to engage in that conversation, getting them to want to learn more. That's what I hope people walk away with, and it should be really exciting as a starting point for this conversation.
How can listeners sign up for and take part in this free event?
We have a Zoom RSVP link. Thankfully, people have been living on Zoom for some time now. So we hope that you will RSVP. We will be sending out a reminder email. So please get on Interfaith Alliance's email list if you are not already on our website. And we will remind you as the event approaches next week and hope that you can join us.
Heading into the final days of 2021, what other agenda items are you spending your time focused on?
You know, our work touches a whole variety of different areas. And, you know, right now on the policy side, we're looking towards the courts. We're looking towards wrapping up the legislative session, what we can still get accomplished. But on the field side, you know, people are wrapping up for the holidays, but the work still continues. Yeah. So we are continuing to support our excellent affiliates and our partners that do work in the field so that coming into the new year, we can hit the ground running is our hope.
Maureen O'Leary is Director of Field and Organizing at Interfaith Alliance, protecting true religious freedom for all. The Founding Religious Freedom webinar is coming up on Tuesday, December 14th, at 12 o'clock noon Eastern Time. Sign-up details are available at interfaithalliance.org. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Good to be here. Thank you.
It's not necessarily the kind of thing that you might expect would get you into trouble. After all, it's 2021, Canada's pretty tolerant nation, and there is plenty in Hindu teachings that supports non-hetero identities and relationships. But then again, it is 2021 with all that has come to mean. And so, when a Hindu pastor in Toronto decided to follow his conscience, things got dangerous really fast. For a look at the latest developments in this sad story, I'm joined by Coalition of Progressive Hindus board member Nikhil Mendalapathy. Nikhil, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Please expand on the origins of this situation. What made the pastor feel the need to act, and how unusual was this wedding?
Sure. So the incident in question, so this is a same-sex wedding that took place earlier this year in the fall in Toronto, Canada. And so this Hindu priest, Sri Ranganathan Kurukal, agreed to perform this wedding. And it was a long journey for this couple who was getting married, these two women, one of whom belonged to the Sri Lankan Tamil Hindu community, and one who was also South Asian, but not from that specific community. And this couple had reached out to several Hindu temples and priests in the Toronto area to see if they would do a same-sex wedding. And, you know, they had received a number of rejections from these different priests and temples. And then finally they came upon Sri Ranganathan Kurukal, who agreed to perform their wedding. And some pictures from the marriage ceremony went viral on social media. And this priest received a lot of backlash from both his family members and conservative members of the community. He actually received multiple death threats over text and phone and social media. And, you know, a number of Hindu organizations in Toronto, you know, kind of kicked him out, and the Hindu Priest Association of Canada put out a statement saying it condemns the marriage and, you know, that other priests should not do the same thing. So there was a huge amount of backlash that, you know, in one sense, it is unexpected to see this level of homophobia, you know, motivated mm-hmm. violence and death threats. But at the same time, we know, you know, in Hindu communities, South Asian communities, there's a lot of work that needs to be done around acceptance and inclusion of LGBTQ community mm-hmm. members and priests and religious leaders who accept them and agree to perform these sort of rites. So mm-hmm. we at Sadhana, Coalition of Progressive Hindus, we're based in the US, but once we heard about this incident, we felt that we needed to, you know, put out a statement of support and get some, you know, a strong message saying that this sort of backlash is, you know, not acceptable and it doesn't live up to the, you know, our own highest teachings within our tradition.
How diverse are Hindu teachings on matters of sexuality and gender?
I would say they are incredibly diverse. There's really no way you can point at here's what all Hindus believe about gender and sexuality. There's an extremely wide variety of texts and teachings and stories, mythological narratives, some of which can be seen as supporting gender and sexual diversity. For example, if you look at depictions of deities, one very popular form of the god Shiva is as Ardhanarishvara, so as half man and half woman. And so that's seen as supporting, you know, different sort of sexual identities and gender expressions. But at the same time, there are also Hindu texts, very, you know, kind of orthodox Brahminical texts such as the Manusmriti, which are also, you know, part of the tradition historically. And these texts come out very explicitly against sort of same-sex, you know, activity or identities. And so there's a pretty wide diversity, but because it's not a really kind of formalized and centralized tradition, that gives us as progressive Hindus the opportunity to really highlight those inclusive and accepting teachings.
So the pastor was well within the scope of what is allowed?
For sure. I mean, I wouldn't say that it's the norm for most Hindu priests or temples here in North America or in India to agree to do a same-sex wedding. It is mm-hmm. still definitely seen as taboo in many ways and doesn't really, you get a lot of backlash saying that, you know, this is a Western thing, it's not our culture. But we as a progressive Hindu organization know that there are many priests and priestesses who do, you know, identify as LGBTQ, who do perform these sort of ceremonies. We have a progressive priest network in our organization. And on an almost daily basis, if not more, we get these requests from same-sex couples, interfaith couples, interracial couples who are looking for accepting inclusive priests to perform their life cycle rituals. And so there's a small but, you know, definitely active progressive priest, you know, segment of our community. But it isn't yet the norm to just go up to any priest and ask them to do a same-sex marriage. And we hope that, you know, through our advocacy and efforts, our communities will you know, change and mm-hmm. it will become more of a everyday sort of thing.
The response was so intense that it seems like it had to be coordinated. Do you think it was?
I am not completely sure what, you know, on that sort of end of what the backlash was, you know, intended to do and who was sort of masterminding it. But it was, you know, pretty out there as far as what we've seen from Hindu communities in the past. You know, this level of making death threats, you know, towards a priest. You know, there was actually someone was arrested as part of this, and this woman who had made some death threats was arrested and charged and had a trial, I think, just last week. And so the Toronto officials and government was acting and protecting, you know, the priest and his family. And, you know, there is definitely a level of institutional backlash that he also received, for example, from this association of Tamil Hindu priests in Canada, who put out this statement, you know, condemning his actions and saying that we wouldn't support sort of a same-sex marriage. But on the other hand, we, our statement that we put out, you know, supporting the priest and the couple, did receive endorsements from several Hindu temples and South Asian organizations, and also progressive priests and Hindu community leaders.
Mm. So what has been the impact of all of this in his ministry and the community where he serves?
Yeah, I think, you know, things were definitely quite tense for a while. You know, he had received backlash from his family, from, you know, people in his community. But we are, you know, we are in touch with the couple that he married and, you know, getting updates on the situation there. And most recently, we have heard that things have sort of died down a little bit and the priest is doing better. You know, the person who made some death threats and, you know, had been threatening him was actually arrested and charged, as I mentioned. And I don't think things are completely back to normal for the priest and his work, but they have definitely died down. And I think the statement that we put out, you know, in support was definitely, you know, of use and both of just moral support and also saying that, you know, we as Hindus are standing with you.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes backlash galvanizes people of conscience to step up and take a stand. Have you seen that happening? And what else should we learn from this series of events?
Yeah, I think, you know, this really kind of high profile, unprecedented level of backlash revealed just the extent of the work that's left to be done in terms of making our temples and communities more inclusive for LGBTQ people. At Sadhana, we make this a core part of our mission is around LGBTQ inclusion in Hindu communities. And so just in the last couple of months, we, for example, around the Hindu festival of Navratri, which took place just a few weeks after this incident with this priest in Toronto, we held a inclusive Navratri celebration with a LGBTQ South Asian organization called Desi Rainbow Parents and Allies. And so that's an organization that works specifically around building acceptance within families, with parents of queer and trans people, and they're sort of providing support for families and communities. And they also see, you know, faith community as an important part of this work. Mm-hmm. And so we held this event with them where for the first time, I think many LGBTQ Hindus and South Asians were able to feel, you know, part of a community that was welcoming them and inclusive. And this is just one of the many different sort of programs and initiatives we do to create egalitarian, inclusive Hindu spaces.
I really would like for you, Nikhil, to talk some more about Coalition of Progressive Hindus. What are your priorities? How can our listeners stay up to date and follow you if they wish?
Yes. So our organization is called Sadhana. Sadhana Coalition for Progressive Hindus is 10 years old. So we were founded in 2011. And we really exist to empower Hindu Americans and, you know, Hindus more broadly to live out the values of their faith through service and community transformation, and also advocacy, like we talked about in this case. So we have a number of different programs and initiatives that provide a platform and a community for Hindus who are passionate about social justice and progressive issues. We have, for example, these children's classes that provide, you know, a progressive interpretation of Hindu teachings. And, you know, many of the children in our classes come from LGBTQ families or multi-faith families where they wouldn't necessarily feel comfortable going to a traditional sort of temple or Hindu kind of Sunday school. Mm-hmm. We also have a liberation theology reading group for sort of those are more people in their 20s and students and things like that. We have these egalitarian inclusive worship ceremonies called satsangs, which have been taking place virtually during COVID, but we're actually transitioning back into in-person satsangs in New York. And we also have a number of service projects that take place, particularly in the New York City area. We have, for example, these flagship beach cleanups that are called Project Prithvi, where we're mobilizing Hindu temples and community members to act for, you know, environmental justice. And then we also do a number of advocacy initiatives around, you know, we're usually the only Hindu members of interfaith coalitions such as the Poor People's Campaign. And we are, you know, part of many different efforts to uplift, you know, immigrant rights, LGBTQ inclusion, and in all of these spaces, add that progressive Hindu viewpoint and interpretation, which is often, you know, not always there. You know, check us out online at sadhana.org. That's sadhana.org. And you can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at facebook.com/sadhanahindus, twitter.com/sadhanahindus, and also on Instagram at that same same username. And you can also write to us at info@sadhana.org, and we'd be happy to learn more about you and you know, get you involved in our advocacy.
Nikhil Manlathaparthi serves as a board member at the Coalition of Progressive Hindus. Nikhil, I thank you for being with us. You're always welcome on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and be a part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week, one person for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see, well,